Well, Mark, I would love to hear more about the Battle of Baltimore and the writing of the Star-Spangled Banner.
So Francis Scott Key was actually a pretty prominent political figure in his day. I mean, we remember him today as the author of the lyric for the Star-Spangled Banner. But in his day, he was a prominent lawyer. He argued cases before the Supreme Court. He was the district attorney for, you know, Washington, D.C., so a very prominent man. And so one of the things he was asked to do by President Madison was actually to negotiate the release of a prisoner who had been taken after the burning of Washington, D.C. So the British – so we're back in sort of 1814, but it's really part of the War of 1812 when Francis Scott Key gets involved. And Key is interesting because he's actually a resident – he's born in Maryland, but he's a resident of the District of Columbia. So I in some ways think of him as sort of one of the first Americans in the sense that he's one of the first people who really saw his hometown, if you will, being the country rather than the state. I mean, we talk about sort of states' rights versus the federal government today. So that same battle was, of course, happening when they were writing the Constitution and trying to negotiate all of these issues. So Key, since he moved from Maryland, where he was born in Frederick, to Washington, D.C., lived in Georgetown, he was sort of a resident, if you will, of the federal government, a resident of Washington, D.C., and really sort of a representative of that. So he knew all of the players in Washington, was very well connected as a lawyer, as a socialite. And so one of the things he gets asked to do is to go on this diplomatic mission to basically take a boat from Baltimore Harbor out to meet the British fleet and negotiate the release of a prisoner named Dr. Beanes, who is sort of a older gentleman. He was a physician, but he was caught up in the aftermath of the burning of Washington, D.C. So it was that purpose that Key had. But this – we think of today as kind of travel as being this kind of instantaneous thing. You know, right. you hop on the boat, you crank up the motor, and you're roaring off. I mean, here we're dealing with sails, right? We're dealing with wind currents. So it takes several days to get out to the fleet, you know. And so this process of him being out there and then coming back is actually over a week long, right? So one of the things that happens is that you stick a national poet on a boat, you know, with lots of time on his hands. He's going to write some poetry, right? So that's, in fact, what he does. And it just happens that he witnesses this momentous event in American history, which is, you know, one other word for the War of 1812 is sort of the second American Revolution. You know, we have the revolution with the Declaration of Independence in 1776. We fight this war against our former colonial, you know, owners and the British, and we get our independence. Well, in 1812, we're sort of fighting a kind of echo of that same battle. It's the same protagonist. It's still Britain. It's still the young United States. But we're a little bit cocky. We're a little bit unprepared. We sort of think that Canada is going to come running us, you know, to us as the savior, and this is all going to be really quick. It turns out to be not so quick. Britain is involved in this other war with this guy named Napoleon
in
Europe. And so when they defeat Napoleon, they sort of send the real troops over to the United States. And when the real troops get here, they're considerably stronger, more skilled, they're pros, as opposed to the kind of volunteer militia, which makes up most of the U.S. force. So they are pretty much wreaking havoc all up and down the coast. And a great example of that is that they march almost unopposed into Washington, D.C., burn all the federal buildings down. The only thing they don't burn is the patent office. And so, you know, the Library of Congress collection sort of, you know, is completely destroyed. It's really a horrendous event in American history, but it's largely symbolic. I mean, this is supposedly the seat of American government, of our identity. But it's actually, you know, a town that's constructed by law, right? The Washington, D.C. is where it is because nobody else wanted to be there. It wasn't attractive land. It's in the middle of a swamp. So it was a town that had been created in 1800. So it didn't actually have a lot of people living there. There wasn't a lot of defenses. There weren't a lot of people for the militia. But one of the guys who was in the militia was a guy named Francis Scott Key. So Key is actually, because he's educated and he's a college graduate, he's one of the officers in an artillery company, the Georgetown Militia, that's actually defending Washington. So he sort of witnesses maybe the most ignominious defeat in American history. You know, fast forward a couple weeks later, you know, he's in Baltimore really expecting the same thing to happen, expecting to see the British, you know, confidently stride into Baltimore and take over the town just as they did in Washington. And of course, it doesn't turn out that way. I mean, the Fort McHenry holds, the citizens of Baltimore repulse a land attack. There's federal troops there as well that sort of combine with the militia. And as far as Key is concerned, he's just witnessed a miracle. I mean, if you read the fourth verse, we think of the Star Spangled Banner as just like a single verse. It's the one we take the time to sing all the time.
Sure.
But that first verse really is a question. You know, will the Star Spangled Banner yet wave for the land of the free and the home of the brave? I mean, it ends with a question mark. By the time we get to the end of the fourth verse, we have a period, right? We know what fate has played out, and that fate was the survival of the nation. I mean, if Britain had won that battle, they might have been able to sue for peace on much more sort of favorable terms to Britain. So it was really a turning point in the war that Baltimore, which was a prominent city at this time, a big merchant city, a big shipping city, a very strong city, an older city, much more prominent, probably the third largest city, I think, in the United States at this time, behind maybe New York and Philadelphia. So it's an important place, and particularly an important place for the U.S. shipbuilding and the marauders that have been sort of harassing the British fleet. So it's a place that Britain would really love to take. And so it's Key becomes witness to this battle, and that's what he celebrates in his lyric.
There does seem to be such a sense of awe and gratitude when you look at the lyrics, and that emotional content comes through.
Absolutely.
So we've talked about the lyrics and what inspired the lyrics. Where did Key find the melody, and why did he choose to use that melody?
That's a great question. So I love the internet as a source of information, but one of the things it does is repeat sort of questionable information. So one of the things is that Francis Scott Key based the anthem on an old drinking song, old British drinking song. Yeah, you hear that a lot. In some ways, there's some truth to that. What it really is a tune from a British or London-based, so an English, musicians club, an amateur club, sort of, with the kind of white wig middle class professional set, so sort of Thomas Jefferson and friends, if you will, but in London, really at the time of our own revolution. So this club was founded in the, 1761. The song was written right about the time of our own revolution, give or take a year or two. But it's very much a tune that's about this sort of men's social club. It's about men coming together for the appreciation of music, for sociality, for sort of networking, I guess is what we would call it today. But, they started all of their club meetings off with a two-hour symphony concert. They had a dinner, and then they would sing songs until the wee hours of the morning, especially if you were one of the younger members of the club. So, it's maybe sort of an episode of Glee attached to a, New York Philharmonic concert would be sort of with dinner interval in between.
Sounds like quite the mishmash.
Yeah, exactly. And they're certainly drinking, in part because in this time in the 1770s, you couldn't just turn on the tap water and, have ice water. You had to have either hot tea, where it killed everything that was in the water, or you had to have something that was fermented.
Safety first.
Yes, exactly. So there certainly was alcohol. It certainly was about conviviality. And so the energy of this song is certainly sort of draws on the fun of the pub. I mean, in some ways, their club anthem, which is called To Anacreon in Heaven, so it goes, To Anacreon in Heaven, where he sat in full glee. So it's the exact same melody you'd recognize, totally different text, but it calls upon this Greek poet, to sort of inspire the members of the club to, sort of friendship and learning and classical values of art. So it has a harpsichord accompaniment. So, you didn't find a harpsichord in the average pub. You didn't find an operatic singer who could handle this very difficult melody, because it's meant for an amateur singer or even a professional to show off. I mean, that's why the melody is so hard to sing. Because it was supposed to be impressive. It was supposed to say, our music club is better than those other music clubs down the street. Just listen to our song. And, we have a really fun time at our meetings. You can tell because it sounds like a drinking song. But it's not really a drinking song. It's a club anthem. And so the way the song is set up is actually with a verse and a chorus. And the verse is sort of the president of the club singing to the members. And then the members echo back. And interestingly, Francis Scott Key will pick up on this same form in the original musical device of the Star Spangled Banner. That last tagline that we sing only once today, Francis Scott Key sang twice, because he did both the sort of president's – it was sung as a solo, and then again the community responded, like the members of the club responded initially.
Right.
But that's where the tune comes from. And what's interesting is that today we don't really think of – we think of like – the creative act of writing a song, that you write this original music, you write these original lyrics that sort of speak from your heart, and then that's, published and copyrighted. And there's this legal ownership. So there's this whole sort of regime about intellectual property that really didn't apply in 1814. So in 1814, really throughout the 19th century, there was this tradition called the Broadside Ballad. And with the Broadside Ballad, the Broadside was basically a newspaper imprint, was just a photocopy, if you will, that was distributed or handed out. And it would only be text. And then what would be signaled at the top, of right underneath the title, it would say tune or air, and then give the title of the tune on which the melody was to be sung. Right, so there was this cultural currency of maybe 100 different melodies that everybody knew, because of course you couldn't turn on the radio in 1814.
Right.
If you're going to make music, you had to make it yourself. You sang it in church, you sang it at home, you sang it at dances and things like that. So there's a much more sort of active, participatory music culture. But lyricists would celebrate important historic events by writing topical lyrics that would basically tell the story. And Francis Scott Key did this. He did this at the Battle of Baltimore after witnessing the sort of miraculous American victory and of Fort McHenry. He did it actually 9 years earlier in 1806 when the heroes from the Tripolitan War, the sort of Barbary Pirates War, sort of came back, and he wrote a piece, When the Warrior Returns, and he used exactly the same melody,
right?
Okay. So for him, for Francis Scott Key, we know that he knew the melody because he'd used it 9 years before. We know that he associated it with sort of heroism, with sort of military, you know, strength and, you know, success. We know that this particular tune, even though it's a British tune, I mean, of course, all American culture at this time is really British culture, right? We're speaking in the English language,
right,
for example, right? So, and he's writing in English, and English is the language of Britain. So we're culturally British. We're culturally connected to our former, you know, colonial owners. So he uses that language. But this tune had been used for presidential campaign songs by Thomas Jefferson.
Oh, wow.
It had been used for songs celebrating George Washington and sort of his heroism, particularly after his death. It had been used for a song to sort of support the presidency of John Adams. So there's this interesting kind of marriage of this melody and sort of American politics. And so Francis Scott Key is using this Broadside tradition, which, as I say, is very sort of normal. The typical newspaper you'd pick up in the day might have a song lyric in it. And he's doing the same thing. He's just writing a set of lyrics to a tune that everybody knows, that he already knows, right, that he expects his readers to be able to sing along to, but also taking a melody that's sort of associated with American sort of, you know, independence, with American political
thoughts.
It already has a history to it, right?
Content.
And it's a fun tune. I mean, it's sort of athletic, it's jaunty. Especially at the time, it's much faster. So we sing it today in this really slow, reverent way because the national anthem is the national anthem.
Yes.
Right? For Francis Scott Key, this is not an anthem. This is a party song.
Yes, celebrating.
Right? This is like, yeah, we won, right? So it's, you know, oh, say, can you see my dawn's early light? So
very
it's,
different
it's,
tone.
Yeah, it has this kind of sort of rippling, tripling, you know, triplet feel that sort of rolls along, more less like the hymn-like structure we have now where it's slowed down to the point where even sometimes it's sung in what's called 4/4 time. It's originally written in more of a waltz 3/4 time. So it's a fascinating history, but it actually makes a lot of sense that Francis Scott Key would choose this tune and that he would expect everybody to know it. Even if we didn't have the evidence that Francis Scott Key had used the same melody for a previous song, as I said, 9 years earlier, mm-hmm. we would have a pretty good guess that he had intentionally written these words to fit this melody. And the reason for that is because it's sort of a weird poetic structure.
Mm-hmm.
So it has 8 lines in it, which is a little bit unusual itself. But more importantly, it has 9 rhymes in those 8 lines.
Oh,
so
okay.
When we say the rocket's red glare, bombs bursting in air gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. So glare, air, and there is a triple rhyme that's in 2 lines. And it always happens in lines 5 and 6 of the 8-line stanzas. And so all of these anacreontic parodies that go back to the original London Musicians Club anthem have that extra rhyme in line 5. And Francis Scott Key does exactly the same thing. And so if you have this unique poetic form matched to an 8-line stanza, at least in my research, signals that it's sung to this very specific melody. And I've found about 200 different sets of lyrics that are written to this melody.
Mm-hmm.
Anti-slavery melodies, anti-alcohol melodies. So a lot of stuff that's about sort of, again, negotiating what America is all about.
American identity.
American identity is very much wrapped up into this tune and the way in which these lyrics are then comments on American life. And so Francis Scott Key is doing the same thing. It's this really this weird historical accident that this one poem or one lyric by this one guy ends up surviving to become the national anthem, whereas we've forgotten, you know, the hundreds of other lyrics that are sung to the same thing.
Sung to the same melody.
Right. But they were meant to be, as I said, topical. They were meant to be about current events.
Right.
One thing that's interesting about Francis Scott Key's text is that it's so abstract. Right, so most of the time when people wrote these lyrics celebrating the heroism of a specific battle, it would mention all of the
– more specifics.
Right. It would mention the military leader, so George Armistead, who was the, you know, the major who was, you know, responsible for the defense of Fort McHenry would have been named in the text and it would celebrate him. And I think there's two things going on. One is that Francis Scott Key is stuck on a boat. And so he's seen the flag. He knows that the British are not rushing in to invade Baltimore. He knows that Americans have won, but he doesn't really have any of the details, right? So he's going to not be able to put in the specifics. On the other hand, I think Francis Scott Key, if you look at his other poetry, and he wrote quite a bit, he tended to these sort of flights of abstract imagination. Mm. He tended to go for the big picture.
That was his style.
Right, exactly. And that's, I think, a reason why his lyric has become the national anthem, because it could sort of survive over time, because it's not so specific. I mean, if it was talking about the nitty-gritty of the battle and, you know, that this guy did this and that guy did that and then General Coburn did this and the British, side. So it would be too specific to be sung at Michigan Stadium on a Saturday afternoon and really sort of celebrate the country as a whole.
Right. So it's able to transcend some of those details and represent the nation. Well, another myth that you hear about Francis Scott Key and the melody is that someone else set the melody for him. Why does that perpetuate?
So when I call it his words a lyric instead of a poem, I'm really sort of making the claim and the observation that he had the melody in his mind when he was thinking of the words.
Right.
And I think knowing that he had written that previous song to the same melody, knowing that the unique rhyme scheme is something he uses, it makes a lot of sense. And the very first imprint, so when Key gets back to Baltimore a couple days later, he has the local newspaper printer put this out, and it's distributed to the soldiers who defended Fort McHenry as a kind of thank you, as a gift of gratitude. And even then, it says Tune and Akron.
Yes.
So we know that the text was never printed by Key anyway, you know, without that tune, right? So it's not that someone else later put it together. On the other hand, Key himself was pretty modest about his sort of role as a poet. You know, so he was justly famous in his lifetime for having written this song, because the song became pretty prominent. There's a big wave of patriotism after the sort of end of the War of 1812 and the victory of Andrew Jackson in New Orleans. And so it's one of the things that galvanizes a sense of national identity. And so this poem sort of comes – or this song comes up at exactly this moment. It looks like a poem because it's – again, it's text on paper.
Mm-hmm,
it was expensive to print music. Right, it's expensive to put in the notes, and not everybody could read it, but everybody knew the tune. So the signal of what the tune was enough. So when we look at the original imprint, it's easy to say he did a poem instead of writing a lyric. And because Key was modest about his accomplishment, he never said, you know, I'm a great poet and I captured this moment. Instead, he said, I was, you know, a poet who witnessed a great moment, and I was compelled then to create a song to celebrate that, to memorialize that. But it's not my creative act. It's me reacting as any poet is compelled to do.
It's a very humble guy.
He's pretty humble in this instant. And so he never left an account, like a firsthand author. You know, he didn't write a blog post as we do today saying, I wrote it and it's all mine and this is how I did it and this I did this and nobody else did this. And follow me on Twitter and check out my Facebook page. You know, that's not what he was saying. Instead, he actually – the original imprint says, you know, a gentleman from Georgetown.
Oh, wow.
You know, it doesn't even – the additional imprint says the name of the tune, but it doesn't say Francis Scott Key.
Wow, that's incredible.
Right? So there's some funny things where you know, there are later imprints of the song that say, like, Mr. McHenry wrote the lyric or, you know, where even Francis Scott Key's name is messed up or his wrong initials are given or things like that. But because Francis Scott Key himself never gave us the story where he narrated it all, other people filled it in. So his relative said, you know, I was there when Francis did this, and I was the one who noticed that, wow, how cool is it? Your lyric just happens to fit this tune I already know. And then famous musicians or, you know, not so famous musicians would say, you know, I was the one who noticed I picked out of my, you know, bag of sheet music that this tune happened to fit it. I was looking for one, and oh, there was one. And then I was the first one who ever sang this poem to this melody. And so I deserve some of the credit for making this important song.
Very
so I think in the lack of ability to fact check that, I guess, other people made the claim in sort of the vacuum left by Francis Scott Key's modesty, right, that he doesn't really make a big deal out of the fact that he wrote it and how he wrote it and what he was thinking and how he did it. And so that absence sort of creates the opening, I think, for misinformation to come in.
I see. And the legend sort of built around that misinformation and like a game of telephone.
Exactly. I mean, and there's pretty amazing stuff about the history of this tune. So we didn't really even know exactly who the composer was of this British tune until really the time of our own bicentennial.
Oh, wow.
So until about 1976, a scholar named William Lichtenwanger was the one who sort of finally built the evidentiary case that it was this harpsichordist who was, you know, a composer working for the Royal Chapel named John Stafford Smith, who also sort of freelanced with the Anacreontic Society. Because, of course, remember they had these symphony concerts, so they would hire, you know, musicians to come in and play the concerts for the club members. So one of those guys was this harpsichordist, and he was a pretty successful composer, both of religious music and also of pop songs of the day. And so they hired him to set the words of the club president. And of course, it's written in this very sort of literary, poetic style with this extra rhyme and all this, again, just to show off the sophistication of the club and their, you know, literary bona fides, if you will.
Sure.
So it's him who's writing the music, but he wasn't a member of the club. So again, when the souvenir imprint is done for the club members, very prominently lists Ralph Tomlinson, who's the president of the club and then the lyricist, but it leaves off the guy who was the young kid who was sort of hired to help out, because I think he was like 20, 21 at the time.
Doesn't really get much credit.
But I think it actually is sort of cool that a guy named John Smith ends up writing the melodies. I mean, what could be a more sort of generic American name
could have guessed that one.
Than John Smith? Francis Scott Key is, you know, it's pretty specific, but John Smith wrote the music.
Do you have any insights into Key's text?
I think what's really amazing about the text is just to read all four verses, right?
Yes.
To realize that there's a question mark at the end of the first verse, that there's really this sense of, well, what's going to happen? And that Francis Scott Key is trying to basically convey the emotional truths of his witnessing of the event, right? So we tend to think, or one of the things that's said about Broadside Ballads is they sort of reported the news. So in a time when not everybody was literate and couldn't read the newspaper, that you could, you know, listen to the town crier in the town square singing a song and you would get the news.
Yeah.
I think it's a pretty inefficient way to get your news. I mean, just imagine if, you know, if CNN or, you know, Fox News, they had to sing everything to you.
Could be amusing.
It'd be very musical. It'd be very, you know, lovely way to experience the news, but it'd be very slow.
Yes.
So if you really wanted to know, hey, did we win or lose?
Get to the point.
You want to say, oh, let me sing you a song. Oh, say, can I see? You know, I don't think so. So it's not so much about what happened, but about what it meant, right? It tells you what it feels like to be there because it's music, because it's lyric, because it's poetry, as opposed to just the facts, right? If you wanted to get the facts, you just ask somebody, what happened, right? And say, we won. If you want to know, well, what does that mean for the country? Does that mean that all of these disparate states will sort of gel together as a nation, that we'll sort of start to believe in ourselves as a country, that we not only can sort of saber rattle and complain about British, you know, continued sort of interference, but we really have the strength as a nation to assert our independence in a new way, then the song becomes more important. So I think it's that emotional truth we really hear. So the original speed of the melody, the compass of the melody, I mean, what makes it so hard to sing today is that it covers what musicians would say is an interval of a 12th, right? Mm-hmm. So if you played it on the keyboard, it would actually take 13 keys in a row to cover the full range of the Star-Spangled Banner. So it's an octave plus a fifth. Most national anthems only take five or six notes. Right. So we have this really wide melody.
Right.
And that's why it's hard to sing. If either you're usually either comfortable singing the low notes or the high notes, but you have to be really quite a singer to handle both. But part of that is the kind of sort of, I think, strength and commitment and passion it takes to express this idea, right? To express the feelings that Francis Scott Key wanted you to feel.
Wow.
So it's not a, you know, God save our glory,
right.
Which is like this really narrow melody, right?
It's much grander.
We open up, So it's just wider. It's expansive. It's more confident. It's
thrilling.
Sort of independent. Yeah, absolutely. So that kind of energy is there, and you need to read the text in that way. The other sort of really significant things I think about the text are the sort of the discussion of sort of the hiring and slave and the way in which free men shall stand. I mean, sort of this notion of Key and slavery in the country, of course, which we're still sort of dealing with the legacy with even today, is very much on Key's mind. The biggest slave market in the United States is Washington, D.C. I mean, as far as where you would buy and sell, you know, people who should be human beings. And so – and Francis Scott Key as a lawyer is often called upon to negotiate these property disputes. And sometimes he defends slaves who should be free men, and sometimes he defends property owners. For him, it's – I think it's more of a point of law than a point of moral justice.
Okay.
So he sort of plays both sides in certain ways. He's actually one of the creators of the American Colonization Society, which is the group that creates Liberia and sort of purchases slaves and puts them on boats and sends them back home to Africa. I mean, of course, they're largely born here in the United States, so to send them back home doesn't really make much sense, but that was their theory at the time. And the Key estate, I mean, the Keys were very wealthy. They owned a big plantation in Frederick, Maryland. So Key inherited slaves. He owned slaves, right? So this is a story of Francis Scott Key and the Star-Spangled Banner that we tend to leave out of the elementary textbooks because we don't really know how to deal with that.
I mean, it's complicated.
It's very complicated. And Key's relationship to slavery, I think, is quite complicated. I mean, as a lawyer in the District of Columbia, he was prosecuting an abolitionist for putting out pamphlets at one point in the 1830s. So he's a difficult man. I mean, his brother-in-law, who he helps get appointed to the Supreme Court as Chief Justice, Roger B. Taney, is Key's brother-in-law, is the one who authors the Dred Scott decision. You know, so there's an incredible thing. And this is, I think, the most amazing thing to me is that Key's father-in-law, so his wife's father, is the owner of Frederick Douglass.
Oh, my goodness.
So there's an amazing kind of conjunction of American history around Francis Scott Key and his family that we've just sort of forgotten.
Glossed over.
Most of, I think, the history we know about the piece really comes from just sort of imagining the scene of Key on the boat and seeing the
– very specific point in time.
Very specific, but it's from the lyric, right? We don't actually know much about Key as a human being. We don't know how devoutly religious that he considered a career in the ministry. So a very interesting guy. But I think there's two things important. One is that he was – I think as someone who sees the question of slavery as a point of law, the notion that the British would offer slaves their freedom if they sort of joined the British cause in the War of 1812, which is something that they did. It's something that the American revolutionaries did as well. For him, that's a kind of betrayal of the social order, right, that you would encourage and foment revolution. So the idea that the British would encourage sort of bring in these mercenaries and encourage slaves to come on to the ship to sort of fight their American owners, legal owners in his mind, was a big problem. And so he vilifies that, you know, within the text where he talks about the foul footsteps pollution of the British, you know, and the way – and he's very – you know, interestingly, Key is – of British descent himself, but when he's on the boat negotiating the release for Beans, he's sort of appalled by the behavior of the British officers, you know, people he imagined as very proper and sort of inspired by, you know, higher ideals, instead are thinking, yeah, let's take over Baltimore. I bet they got a lot of gold candlesticks there we can steal. I mean,
I see.
There's a sense of sort of pillaging the countryside and really sort of bitter revenge for the, you know, maybe for the revolution, but certainly for the burning of York, right? Which – so when the United States at the beginning of the War of 1812, we sort of invade Canada and Among the other things we do is burn York, which is one of the Canadian capitals, to the ground. It's Toronto today. But ostensibly, the burning of Washington, D.C. was also kind of a retribution or punishment for that. And Baltimore is right on the heels of that. So he's appalled at the sort of behavior of the British, who he had imagined as very sort of educated and sophisticated and sort of proper, honorable. So that's sort of disgust is reflected in the text. The other thing I think is really interesting is that final verse, which we often don't sing today, but which is often included in hymnals in particular, because as I said, Key was devoutly religious. He was Anglican, considered a career in the ministry. And he talks about, you know, sort of that divine providence has saved the nation, right? And says, you know, in God is our trust. And for him, as I said, I think in many ways, the burning of Washington, which he had witnessed himself, was a kind of divine punishment for the sort of misguided policies of the United States in declaring war
at
all.
That's fascinating.
And he saw a kind of, you know, the survival of Baltimore, the redemption of Baltimore as a kind of redemption of the whole country, as a kind of God changing his mind at a certain point. You know, to sort of say, well, this country has suffered enough, it's paid its price, now I can support the young colonies. For him, that final stanza is really a kind of, you know, sunrise, but it's sort of a divine redemption of the nation. So
it's very powerful.
Yeah, it is. But that's certainly very much a part of Key's
personal
imagination
beliefs
and his personal beliefs. And so this, I think, is another thing. You know, when we look at this text of the Star Spangled Banner today, we think of it as a very natural thing. You know, at least I've sung it, you know, since I was a little kid over and over again in school, at sporting events, graduations, whatever. I mean, it's really easy to sing it in a kind of mindless way, not really think
pay
about
attention.
The text. You know, but and I think the country in some ways has grown along with the song, right? So we've become this sort of world superpower, sort of the claims of having this, you know, in a sense, the strongest anthem melody in the world. You know, we're the strongest country in certain ways, and militarily, economically, you know, culturally, the dominance of Hollywood, all sorts of things make this a really strong country. In 1814, not so much.
Right.
Right. 1814, we're barely holding it together in the face of British, you know, attack. We don't have no taxation. There's no strong government. We have this big national debt. You know,
there's a lot of certainties,
a lot of uncertainty. And so what Key is writing, although he's responding to this historical moment in Baltimore Harbor, he's also sort of imagining a glorious future for the country. It's, you know, the text is a kind of vision for where he hopes the country will go.
Yes.
And we see that today as sort of maybe a dream fulfilled, as being sort of natural, you know, no need for commentary. But the kind of inspiration I really take from the Star Spangled Banner is that Francis Scott Key is just like, I mean, he's an important guy, but he's also just one citizen. And he lays out a vision for the country, a sort of an act of citizenship, a place he hopes the nation will go. And, you know, he turns out to be right. And that's part of the reason why the song survives. It's certainly the Civil War, the success of the Union. You know, if the Star Spangled Banner flag had fallen in the Civil War, the Star Spangled Banner song wouldn't have survived, right? So there's lots of chances for his vision not to occur, but it does. And but I see that kind of his creativity, his sort of taking this song, putting his personal hopes and dreams for the country into a, you know, artistic expression, as really a kind of model for all of us today to take an active role in, as citizens, to try to make the country what we want. You know, so it's that question mark at the end of the first stanza, I think, for me, you know, especially since that's the one we sing today, sort of constantly brings up this question, say, can you see that Star Spangled Banner wave, the land of the free and the home of the brave? I mean, what does it mean for us to be the land of the free in 2015, 2016, 2020, 2030? You know, so that's a question we have to answer for us today. And I think it's sort of beautiful that our national anthem is really, you know, something that seems like it's confident, seems like it's certain, seems like it's monumental and permanent, is also this sort of fleeting question that we have to answer you know, for ourselves and for the future about what kind of country we want to have. And that it's not something that's about, you know, sort of a snapshot of something permanent and unchangeable and unmutable, but it's rather something that's always in flux, always becoming, you know, the question of are we free is something we have to answer every day.